Welcome to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Crime Beat, discussing the issues and controversies of the criminal world with famous personalities. Your hosts, Ron Chepsik and Will Hareb, will guide you into the deep underbelly of the criminal mind. To learn more about your hosts, their books, and past shows, visit the Crime Beat archive page. And now, your hosts, Ron and Will.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Will Hareb, your co-host and producer of Crime Beat. This hour-long broadcast puts you, the listener, into the back alleys and the boardrooms of the world's most fascinating subject, crime. Our guests will allow you to experience their lives, and this is exactly where you want to be on Thursday night, and it's right here on Crime Beat, brought to you by the Artist First World Radio Network. Tonight, we're broadcasting live from our studios in Thunder Bay, Canada, and Rock Hill, South Carolina, that Confederate state. Tonight's Crime Beat show presents special guest, Mr. Frank Calabresi, Jr., co-author of Operation Family Secrets, How a Mobster's Son and the FBI Brought Down Chicago's Murderous Crime Family. It's going to be a fascinating broadcast, so stay tuned. You won't want to miss this one, that's for sure. Now, at this time, I'd like to introduce our listeners to my co-host and moderator and executive producer and the sleuth of all sleuths, the unflappable Mr. Ronnie Chepsik. Ron is an award-winning author, documentary producer, and director, publisher. He's a two-time Fulbright scholar to Bangladesh and Indonesia, and a consultant to the History Channel's Gangland TV series. His book, Sergeant Smack, has been optioned for a movie. His latest project, the just-released award-winning documentary, The Frank Matthews Story, The Rise and Disappearance of America's Biggest Kingpin. For more information, please go to Strategic Media Books. That's www.strategicmediabooks.com. Given his books, his extensive travels and in-depth interviews, Ronnie Chepsik today is the leading expert on the fascinating world of crime. Also, be sure to visit his website. That's www.ronchepsik.com. You can also join him on Facebook and Twitter. Now, here's the guy with the big picture and his, the finger on the pulse of crime, Mr. Ronnie Chepsik.
Thank you, Willie. And here's a little bio on my co-host. Willie is a freelance writer, broadcast journalist from Thunder Bay, Canada, who's assisted me on some of my crime books. Willie is currently involved in the international shipping business, where he's a contributing writer to several trade publications. This year, he published Movers and Mavericks, an anthology about influential people from the Thunder Bay area. Volume 2 is coming out next year, and he's got another book about the famous Ganelda shipwreck that sank 100 years ago in Rossbourne, Lake Superior. Willie.
Well, thanks for that, Ronnie boy. Our book, Movers and Mavericks, is sold out, I'm pleased to report. And it's coming out in ebook format later this fall. Well, Ronnie, just before we reach into our mailbag and read some of the mail we received over the past couple of weeks, I'd like to thank all our listeners out there from around the world, that's around the globe, for tuning into Crime Beat. We're thrilled and delighted to announce we've had overwhelming positive comments and thumbs up about our program. We're averaging over 130,000 listeners every week now from more than 120 countries around the globe. And that is certainly something to cheer about. I'd like to thank all our production people at Artist First World Radio Network, in particular, Corey, Scott, and Tony for making the show possible. Also, a special thank you to the Ryan Brothers for allowing us to use the great music for our theme song. It's got the Beat the Crime written all over it. Like I said many times before, Ronnie, Internet radio is the place to be. It's great to be recognized, and I guess that proves we're on the cutting edge of Internet radio. Well, Ronnie, now here's this week's mailbag. This one's from Francine of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Francine writes, "Your show with Richard Moody, author of The Charmer, was very entertaining. Just goes to prove that women have to be vigilant in who they bring into their lives. I know what I would have done with this predator and piece of garbage, and it wouldn't have been pretty. He'd be a eunuch before he knew it. Great show, fellas. I'm a regular listener." Hey, Ronnie, Francine is one tough customer. Any comments?
Yeah, what's a eunuch? Yeah, I could.
Hey, look in the mirror, buddy.
Yeah, that's what they say. That's what they tell me to do. Yeah, but he was a charmer, and you remember the courtroom. Richard Moody, the prosecutor, talked about being in the courtroom, and this guy actually defended himself, and he got a hung jury because he was good looking and knew how to charm women. So I think she's talking too quickly about this character, Richard, the charmer. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. Well, we welcome Francine's very cogent comments, and Francine, keep the letters coming. Now, this one is from DJM from somewhere in the United States. DJM writes, I love the shows with the mafia stuff. I see you like it too. My suggestions for the show are Albert DeMille for Sins of My Father, Jerry Capici, Murder Machine. Hey, good choices, DM. What do you say to that, Ronnie?
Yeah, Jerry Capici is one of the best writers around on that, and we've got a really tight schedule. More people have found out about our show, so we're getting booked up later and later, but we'll certainly keep those names in mind for future shows, and thank you to our listener. Willie?
Well, thank you. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks to DGM. Thanks a lot. Keep those letters coming, as I said before. Now, well, Ronnie, you want to give our listeners out there in that wide expanse of cyberspace a preview of next week's show, please?
Yes, we have a really interesting show. Susan Burke, who serves as lead counsel on an ongoing series of cases challenging rape and sexual assault in the military. I saw Susan on one of my favorite shows, Bill Maher, and she was terrific, but she was only on for 10 minutes, so we're going to have her on for a longer period of time, and she's going to talk about this very serious problem. Willie?
Well, she's a real crusader. I'm looking forward to the interview. I'm sure she's going to tell a lot of insights, just give us a lot of insights in what's really been happening behind the scenes in the military. Well, Ronnie, tell us, tell our listeners out there what you've been up to. Give us an idea of what you're working on and what kind of beer you've been drinking down there in the old Dixie land there, buddy.
Well, I drink my favorite beer, you know, that Kingfisher from India. And I found out last week that American Gangster Most Evil is going to be on in August. And I was down in Miami for a couple of shoots, for a couple of those episodes. Another gangster series, and it's going to be on the Biography Channel, and we'll provide more details, and I'm supposed to be on a couple of those segments in September, and I'm invited by the DEA Museum to give a lecture November 22nd on the Cali Cartel, the world's most powerful drug trafficking organization, which, of course, they did a book called Drug Lords. Willie?
Yeah, that's a great book. I urge all our listeners out there to get that book. All your books are really great, Ronnie. I'd like to toot your horn now and again. And I'd like to bug you now and again, too. But anyway, good show on that. Well, Ronnie, as you know, the Beat to Crime never stops and never stops. Every week, just to get you in the mood, we present our rap sheet part of the program. Our rap sheet feature is a potpourri of news and events from the world of crime. And crime news you might have missed. Now, here's this week's rap sheet item number one. Dateline, August 6th, 2012, Los Angeles, California. Pirates on the highways, cargo theft costing USA billions. It's the costliest crime in America, according to the FBI. Organized crime drives it, money fuels it, and it's gone international. It happens three times a day somewhere in America, and in California it happens twice as often as anywhere in the United States. Hey, Ronnie, pirates on the highways, swashbuckler road pirates.
Yeah, man.
Your comments to this story.
$35 billion lost annually in cargo theft. And you know what the most stolen item is? It's a sign of the times. Guess what it is? Food.
What's that?
Food.
What is it?
Food is stolen.
Holy
most of, yeah, right. Followed by electronics, metals, and clothing. And of course, California leads all states, as we would imagine. And, you know, these poor truckers can't even leave their trucks at the truck stop anymore to get a bite to eat. Evidently, some of these crooks could steal these trucks in 30 seconds. 30 seconds it takes them to get away with the truck.
Amazing, I tell you. Well, I tell you, a lot of these guys are ex-truckers themselves, so they know what they're doing.
Right.
You know, it just goes to prove desperate times brings desperate measures. People want food, they'll go out and get it to try to get it.
Right, wherever it comes from.
Now, here's a rap sheet item number two. That's right, that's for sure. Now, here's rap sheet item number two. Dateline, August 3rd, 2012. Duluth, Minnesota. Brandon Shaw bites police dog, faces felony for alleged canine tightening. Hey, Ronnie, Brandon Shaw was arrested in Duluth, Minnesota for an alleged assault of a police dog. Shaw, 21, was pursued by police on suspicion of car theft when he ran out of gas in an alley. A police officer warned him to get on the ground lest he be bitten by his canine. But Shaw wouldn't be apprehended without a fight. Hey, Ronnie, tell our listeners more about this.
Yeah, usually it's dog biting man, but this is man bites dog and a canine. on top of that, he actually struck the dog on the muzzle before running away. You know, he bit him on the head. he put the dog in the superior animal hospital, and his name is Bleck. Can you imagine a dog named Bleck?
Sounds like that Illinois governor down there who's in the slammer.
Right, but the maximum penalty for the crime is 3 years and a half in prison and a $10,000 fine.
Wow.
You know, this is such great news. I mean, it's the news that our listeners could definitely use, right, Willie? So we'll keep an eye on it. Where do you find these stories?
News from the blues, man, I tell you. I guess this guy's hollering like a lost coyote now that he's in a slammer. Hope Black, the police dog, is okay. And he got his rabies shots, man.
Right.
Anyway, it's amazing, these stories. We're not making them up, folks. Just before we get on to our special guest tonight, we'll take a brief station identification. This is Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are tonight, we hope you enjoy our show this evening. You can listen to our broadcast weekly on this internet band on Thursdays at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. All our shows are archived for 24/7 listening, so if you missed one, you can check us out anytime. If you have any questions for our guests, you can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com. We'll also be glad to incorporate your ideas into our future programs. Well, Ron, Crime Beat's featured guest tonight is Mr. Frank Calabresi, Jr., co-author of Operation Family Secrets, How a Mobster's Son and the FBI Brought Down Chicago's Murderous Crime Family. Operation Family Secrets is the chilling, true story of how the son of the most violent mobster in Chicago made the unprecedented decision to work with the FBI and the U.S. Attorney's Office to incriminate his own father. It's going to be a great show. You won't want to miss this one. Take it away, Ronnie.
Thank you, Willie, and welcome to the show, Frank Calabresi, Jr.
Hey, Ryan, Willie, how you guys doing?
Man, fine. You're out there in Arizona.
Yes.
How's the weather out there? Hope it's chilled off.
It's warm, but we get used to it. I'll take this over the cold.
And it's the cold of Chicago, where you're from. But I'm enjoying the book. You know, I've been slowed down a little bit by the Olympics, but it's a great read. It really strips the glamour off the mafia. And congratulations on getting this book done.
Thank you.
And it took a little courage, didn't it? I mean, you know, you had to tell your story, and it's not a pleasant story. I mean, it's an amazing story, but not very pleasant. And you had to sit there with a couple of writers. What was that experience like?
Well, when I wasn't going to write a book, but then people around me told me, you know, you need to tell the story. I mean, and the story was, it's about a family story, okay? Mm-hmm. You know, it's about how I had to follow my father into organized crime, how I had to betray my father in the prison yard. Mm-hmm. And I wanted it to be a simple read.
Mm-hmm.
So I had gotten the brothers, Keith and Kent Zimmerman. I believe they're on their 21st book now, 3 New York Times bestsellers, our book included as one of them, and they got a great way of writing. And I've heard all along that most people can't put it down less than 200 pages into it. So,
right. I will vouch for that, Frank, but because it's, you know, like I said, it's really a great read, but you've had a little trouble promoting it, right? I read that interesting article in the Huffington Post where someone actually phoned in a death threat, you know, threatening to kill the people that worked at that border store in Chicago, right? What was that like? Was that a common occurrence or just an isolated occurrence? And was that serious? Do you think that was serious?
I don't think it was serious. The way I was taught, organized crime is not going to phone in a call like that. If they're going to come and get you, they're gonna wait. They're going to plan it out. They're not going to call the store and just try to hurt innocent people. My biggest problem out there, I should say, is that somebody watching these movies and glorifies this, think that they're going to get in good with somebody by trying to come up and kill me. But the actual guys that are left, there's nothing in it for them to try to hurt me. So, no, it was, but you got to take everything serious. I mean, they weren't saying they were going to hurt me. They said they were going to hurt the employees and the people coming.
Right, right.
I don't want to see that for a book.
Right. You said you had to do the book. Is there a message for other people? I mean, not everybody belongs to the mafia, and not everybody has a father like you, and we'll get into, you know, your relationship with your father in a little bit. Well, but you think this book is going to help other people?
Well, what I wanted people to see is Hollywood glorifies crime, or any kind of organized crime, not just Italian, Irish organized crime, but any kind of organized crime, gangs, what I wanted to show in here is that, you know, that the dark side of it, the downside of it, like anything, there's always a good side, the downside. And how you, when you take that crime and you bring it into your home, how it can corrode your family. And not only did my father do it with our family, but then in turn, I did it with my family. I made the same mistake he did. So I wanted people to get that family part.
Right. Well, let's talk about, you were born, talk about your family and how it, you know, corrupted everything, you know, in your life. You were born into the mafia life, right? And to talk a little bit about your father, like, who was your father, and give him some background. He was Sicilian, right?
Yeah, well, real quick, I'm half Irish, half Italian, so I can never be a made member of the mob. But I was born into this. On my Irish side, my grandfather is in the history books. Ed Stix-Hanley ran with the O'Donnell gang. In history, the O'Donnell gang was really Al Capone's biggest thorn in the side. He had many shootouts with Al Capone. And then on my Italian side, my father and my uncle were both made members of the mafia.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I was going to say real quick was, you know, at family gatherings, it was kind of rough. You know, whose side do I choose? Kind of conflicted there, huh?
Right. Well, when you say the mafia, we're talking about the outfit. So maybe you could briefly explain, you know, what is the outfit? I understand it was established by Al Capone. You know, almost 80, 90 years ago. Talk a little about just the outfit and what it stands for and what it is.
Well, the outfit is an arm of organized crime. It's an arm of the mafia or La Cosa Nostra, depending on what you want to call it. But in Chicago, we called it the outfit. And in Chicago, instead of five families, there was basically one family, and it was more split up into territories in the city.
Wow. Now, your father was a made man, as you explained. When did you find out that you were a member of a mafia family?
Well, you know, my father started grooming me at a young age. And again, he groomed me. You know, he didn't just say, hey, son, you know, what do you think you're going to do when you grow up? How about coming into organized crime with me? You know, there was no handbook, application. But he... you know, as I was young, you know, I knew that I didn't live, I knew I didn't have a 9-to-5 father. He didn't really talk about it and bring it home then. He was a good dad. But, you know, you had an idea. And then after Godfather came out, you know, we were just young teenagers, and we thought we knew what was going on, but we really didn't know.
Right.
I slowly knew over the years as he slowly brought me into it more and more and taught me about it more and more and groomed me.
Right. Now, to set your age, you're 50, I understand, right? I read a newspaper article said you were 50.
I'm actually 52 now.
Oh, you're 52 now, so the article's a little
bit
older on that sort of stuff. But, you know, you have a very poignant scene in there. You know, a lot of people out there, you know, have fathers that their sons, and their father may take them into the bathroom and tell them a little bit about their first date with a girl, but your father took you into the bathroom, and what did he talk about?
Well, he was grooming me, and he was talking to me about that he had to murder somebody and why he had to murder somebody and the do's and don'ts and how they set the person up and how easy it is to set people up. And, you know, at the time, I didn't, again, going through my head like it just says, you know, why am I, you know, I wonder what the other kids in the neighborhood, their fathers are telling them right now. I'm sure they're not in the bathroom. Although I did come from a neighborhood with a large... population of organized crime, but a lot of the guys I grew up with, their fathers made sure they didn't get into it.
Why do you think your father wanted you? You had two other brothers as well, right? Are they older than you? Were you selected specifically, or younger? Were you specifically selected as the child that was going to carry on the tradition?
Well, you know, the mob looks for tough guys. They look for earners. They look for good thieves, and I think my father's seen a lot of him in me. And
that's not very complimentary, is it?
No. And you know, I can handle myself as a young kid, and you know, he did catch me stealing, and you know, I didn't get caught by the law, got caught by him, but and I knew how to go out and make money too, and I don't, you know, and I can't really honest answer. Answer that for 100% why he kept wanting to pull me back in, but he's seen something in me.
Right. But there's another important character in your life. We'd mentioned the two brothers. Also, your Uncle Nick, right?
Correct.
Yeah, could you tell about who Nick was and what your relationship with him was?
Well, my Uncle Nick was my father's brother, and he was like an older brother to me, but he was just a very close uncle. And my uncle was pulled in it just like I was. The difference between me and my uncle was that my father groomed me over a period of years. And I had my uncle in my ear telling me, you know, right and wrong. My uncle got pulled in, gets fitted grooming, and he wasn't even in for less than a year, and he had to murder somebody. And once he did that, there was no turning back.
But he was a made member too, right?
Correct.
Right, but you describe, you know, your uncle, he was soft-spoken, he was your favorite uncle. Meanwhile, your father was brutal and violent, right? And he would take, you know, the fist to you, right? And he was also very strong, too, so that's, that must have been kind of scary, you know, growing up.
Well, the scariest part of my father, and I try to bring it out a little bit in the book, but naturally, I mean, originally there was 800 pages, Random House wanted it.
Right.
Well, what I had to deal with what my father was, I had to deal with three different fathers. He was a sociopath. There was a part of him that was a father that was the best father ever. And you'd be dealing with that father, and then the next meeting you'd be dealing with an abusive father, and then at times you can see that look in his eyes. I mean, you know, my father's favorite method of killing somebody was strangling you with a rope and then cutting your throat from ear to ear. So, you know, I'd see that part of him too. And he didn't draw the line with family members or anybody. If he felt you had to go, and he made that decision. So the hardest part growing up was I didn't know which father I was dealing with at times, and you never knew.
Right. Yeah. You know, he was described as a killing machine, but also you described this, you know, this change, and I think we should bring in Tony the Hook LaPietra, right? Because he came under the influence of this guy, this character, this mobster, godfather, and that had a big impact on him, right? Which helped maybe change him over time.
Right. Angelo de Hook LaPietra was a boss. He was a very treacherous man, and he was feared by many. And he did the same thing to my father that my father was doing to me. He seen a lot of stuff in my father. And, you know, he slowly groomed my father. And as he groomed my father over the years, my father changed just like him. Mm-hmm. And these were treacherous men. I mean, treacherous men. Some of the most powerful, badass guys in the city were scared to be in a room with these guys.
Right. Well, you know, your mother had courage, right? Because she actually divorced him.
Yeah, and again, my father was one of the things, he was a master manipulator, and he had a girlfriend, his Gumad, who he wound up marrying and starting a family with, and he kind of manipulated my ma into divorcing him, and my ma went along with it. Again, everybody went along with my father to appease him because we didn't want to see that other side.
Right, right. Well, you were 19.
Hey, Ronnie,
excuse me. Go ahead, Willie. Well, you were 19.
Yeah, I got a question for Frank, Ronnie.
Sorry
to interject, but I got a question for Frank. You know, the culture that your father gave you right at the beginning, trying to groom you. Give us some background about your father's father, your grandfather. Did he do the same thing with Frank Sr.? Describe that, please.
See, my father grew up rough. He grew up on the street. As a kid, he ran a newspaper stand, him and his brothers. I mean, their shoes were hand-me-downs, and they have holes in the bottom, and they put cardboard inside the shoe, and that's how they did it. I tell a story a lot about when my father was a young kid, and my grandmother and grandfather didn't have no money for Christmas, and my father came home and gave my grandfather, I don't know if it was $50 or $100, and says, look, you know, get my brothers and sisters, because he was the oldest of seven kids, get them stuff, get food for Christmas, I just want a fishing pole. Mm-hmm. And for years, my father used to say, he never got that fishing pole. At six, my father was a tough kid, so he was fast with his hands, and that was one of his downfalls to his life. But, you know, at 16 years old, my grandfather drove him down to the Army because he says, I can't control you, maybe the Army could, you know, and the Army couldn't control my father either. And so my father had a rough life growing up, and so did his father. His father, if he wasn't home on time, he had to sleep in a doghouse outside, if it was winter or summer. So they came from a very rough family.
But, you know, he wasn't adverse to allowing you to enter the mob, and you, you know, describe how you entered the mob when you were 19 years old, right? And you became associated with the 26th Street Chinatown crew?
Right. But I was mostly with my father. See, there was a lot of things I didn't really buy into the mob. I bought into my father.
Was he grooming you? Was he trying to groom you to be his successor?
Yes, he was grooming me to take over his. He knew I never could be a made man. He used to tell me many a times, you know, he took it, but he really didn't want it. He didn't want somebody to control his life the way a mob controls your life. So, you know, and he always taught me, you know, how there wasn't a lot of trust. And, you know, he'd tell me a lot of dark sides about it and, you know, how you had to play the game with him, you know.
But he was...
He was grooming me to take over and work with him.
Right. But he knew you had to be really tough to exist in this dog-eat-dog world. And did he train you to be a hitman?
Yeah, he did in time. And in the book, we talk about how... you know, at first, you know, how he was grooming me, and then at one point, you know, I bought into it. You know, I was ready to die for my father. I bought into the whole thing. I bought into my father, bought into my uncle. I didn't buy into somebody in the mob giving an order to kill somebody.
Right.
Well, there was one of the murders that was coming up. It's the Ficarada murder, and this guy would not get in the car with my father and my uncle. Well, Ficarada was doing some stuff to my father and my uncle, one of them stealing money. And so this was personal for me. This was something that he was doing to our family.
Right.
So I was ready to do this. And my father knew I was ready. And my uncle was actually the one that saved me. He was the one that talked me out of it.
Right.
He told my father he can do it himself, which we always were taught you can't do it one person. And, you know, during the scuffle, that's when my uncle shot himself in the arm fighting with this old-timer who was really fast with his hands and good with guns. And he had to chase him to the middle of the street and gun him down in the middle of the street. So, you know, that was my turning point. And I didn't realize back then that my uncle actually saved my life. And I think there was something there that my father let my uncle talk him out of me doing this, too. And at the time, I was pretty mad, you know, because I was ready to go. Later on, when I started seeing everything and what it was really about, I was happy that I didn't cross that line.
Right.
But I was ready to cross that line.
Right. So you never ended up having to do a hit.
No.
Which is quite amazing, right? Because, you know, mob guys are expected to do that.
Correct.
I was
involved in directly with a lot of them. I knew, you know, which was a
weird thing. You were actually there on the scene, right?
Well, if not in the scene, in the area, or I had a specific role in what I needed to do.
Right.
And I was there practicing. So I had a lot of roles in it.
Right. In your book, you describe really interesting the outfit's made ceremony. You can never be a made man, as you describe. Well, how did you get to see this? And tell us a little bit about, briefly tell us what was involved.
Okay, I didn't see it. It was told, I knew when my father, you know, my father...
Oh, you didn't see it?
Explained it. No, I couldn't be in the room. And you got to remember something.
Right, excuse me, you described the scene, described what the ceremony was about.
Yeah, and basically the ceremony is it's a ceremonial thing, and I'm sure most people know with the finger pricking and burning a holy card. And basically what it is you make this mafia family before God and before your own family. If you're called upon, you come. If you don't come, it's an automatic death penalty for you. And that's why you see a lot of members get killed by people they supposedly trust, because they call it whistled in. If you get whistled in and, you know, you don't go, it's an automatic death penalty. Your loyalties, you know, earning. You would have had to kill somebody to also qualify to get in this.
Right. Willie, let's take a break, and we'll be back with this fascinating interview with Frank Calabrese, Jr.
You bet. What a great interview with Frank Calabrese. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chapsick and Will Hareb. Our very special guest this evening is Mr. Frank Calabrese, Jr., co-author of Operation Family Secrets, How a Mobster's Son and the FBI Brought Down Chicago's Murderous Crime Family. Now back to Ron and Mr. Frank Calabrese, Jr.
Thank you, Willie. And Frank, you had three co-authors, Keith and Ken Zimmerman and Paul Pompian. You know, why so many authors? You know, I've written close to 30 books, and, you know, you work with maybe two, but... You had actually had three on an As Told To book. Why so many?
Well, what we did was we put together a group. Paul comes from Chicago. He's a producer, and he's had movies and stuff. And so he helped out with some of the historical facts in the book, but mostly it was the brothers that was their end. And now the other end that Paul's working on right now is the movie end. And things are going really well with that. And... you know, we have Gary Ross, who did Hunger Games. He signed on to direct. I got Nick Pileggi, who did, you know, he's on executive producer, co-screenplay. I have Stephen Sheff, Stephen Sheff, and he just did Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps.
Right.
He's going to screenplay it. We have independent financiers. So, what we're trying to get through this movie, and why I have so many people on is, I want people to understand the story. This is not just a mob story. The mob part is the background. It's a family story, mm-hmm. And when I talked to Stephen Sheff to see if he got it after he read the book, he came back and I got to read you an interesting email that he sent. And he basically said real quick, he just wanted to know, I've been going through the Operation Family Secrets material. I find it absolutely enthralling. He says, this is a haunting, scaring, troubling, and tearing, compelling story. It has both intimacy and scope, a genuine moral complexity, as well as a primal emotional directness. It raises the sort of piercing questions about duty, family, loyalty, betrayal that informs Shakespeare and the Greek. He gets it. It's the depth. It's the tragedy. I had to go against my father. I love my father.
Wow.
I hated his ways. So, I want people to see, and that's why so many women enjoy reading this book, because it's a part about family.
Right.
I want you to understand there's a lot of victims out there that you don't realize.
Mm-hmm.
Well, nobody wants to relate to the victims in these Hollywood movies. They all relate to the gangsters.
Right. I read where you were a big fan of The Sopranos.
Yes.
And how does it compare to The Sopranos? Is The Sopranos pretty realistic?
What I loved about The Sopranos is the family parts. I mean, you had the gangster part. Yeah, I mean, it was some great writing, I mean, And kids, most kids growing up, like Tony's son did,
mm-hmm.
he's trying to have a hard time finding his way in life.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes through all these different changes.
Mm-hmm.
I like to relate to Christopher, his nephew, Christopher bought into it all, and
mm-hmm.
Tony was like, don't do as I do as I say.
Mm-hmm.
And Christopher always said, how come I'm the only one that's got to follow the rules?
Right.
And Christopher got made. And he's like, all of a sudden he goes, I got Paulie in my room sniffing my wife's underwear. I got to pay him every month. I got no money. And in the end, who killed Christopher? The one guy that he loved,
right.
Tony.
Right.
So, there's a lot of, James Gandolfini, all his actions, his facial actions, looks are just like my dad.
Right.
I mean, my mother, some people couldn't watch it because it was just too hairy.
Wow, so your movie's going to be the second coming of The Sopranos, right? so to speak. But we'll let our audience judge when the movie comes out. Let's get back to the main thread of your story. You describe how you made numerous attempts to go straight. You tried to go into business. You talk about your father. And what he did to you, you alluded to that, and that related to your cocaine habit, right? Where you started stealing from the family business. Talk about that and what your father did, which was quite amazing. The anecdote about the garage.
And one thing I want to make clear here, is once I bought into all this,
mm-hmm.
I became a bad person. So in no way through any of this have I ever claimed that I was any kind of victim.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it had to go with me trying to get away and break away. I tried to break away from my father after a while. I started a family. I had two small kids, and I decided this wasn't for me no more. And so I decided to steal from my father. And I got to understand, here's a guy, money is his God. I knew where all his money was. He owed me some money, too, but still, I still took money no matter what he owed me or whatever. I was wrong, I took his money. But I took it under the preference that, I would return it, but I needed money to break away from him. So I invested in some restaurants. It was the 80s. Everybody did cocaine. I did it a little bit. I said, this is great. And I learned now I have addictive personality with anything. I said, how can I make money with it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I started selling it, making money, knowing that if anybody in Chicago mob or my father finds out that I'm dealing with drugs, that it's a death sentence.
Wow.
And through all this, I'm learning other mobsters are doing it behind closed doors, too. And I'm
right.
trying to tell my dad, but I can't tell him too much because he's going to say, how do you know? But anyways, it came to an end. He didn't know about the drugs, but he knew I stole the money. And when he found out, he says, now I control your life. And I didn't care anymore. I didn't care about life. I thought maybe I was better off.
So you were just like any other mobster that screwed up, right? I mean, yeah. you weren't his yeah. son. You're just like, and unfortunately, he didn't kill you, but, I mean, he could have easily done that.
Well, he got me in a garage, and, you know, everything he taught me, you know, he used, and when I walked through that door, and I was like, oh, shit, you know, almost
right.
like on Goodfellas when Joe Pesci walks in the room.
Right.
And my father pulled out a gun in sock and stuck it to my face, grabbed me, and he said, I'd rather have you dead than disobey me. And I looked in his eyes, and I thought for sure that I wasn't going to make it out of the room. I was dead. And so I started crying. I started hugging him. In my mind, it's running fast. I got to do whatever I can to get out of this room. And when I got out of this room, I'm never going to trust my father again.
Right. He never really, he wasn't really going to kill you, right? He was just a tough mobster that was trying to scare, like you said, the shit out of you.
No, he...
Do you think he really would have killed you?
Well, it was to a point where he knew he couldn't control me, and he seen me losing fear of him. And, you know, I feared him for a long time. And towards the end, right before we went to jail, I started not to fear him. Because when you reach the bottom, you know, I just lost the fear.
Wow.
And I think he's seen that. And I knew too much.
Hey, Frank.
Sorry. Yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah. I'm going to jump in with one, Ronnie, for Frank. Did you guys get into any fights physically, Frank, with your old man? Did you guys really tussle? Any fist fights? I know you were a boxer. Did you guys get into it at all?
I never raised my hands to my dad. He kicked my ass many a times, never raised my hands to him.
Wow.
I get asked that question, why didn't I raise my hand? I don't know why. You know, it wasn't the beatings that hurt. It was my heart that hurt when he was beating me.
Mm-hmm.
He was so fast with his hands sometimes, and it killed me that, you know, I was so loyal to him, and he was so fast with his hands. The physical part of the beatings, my face would be swelled up. That didn't bother me. It's just my heart was so broken.
Wow. Now... let's talk a little bit about what you were doing. You were, you know, you're involved with everything your father was, right? An uncle, the loan sharking, gambling, extortion, and all that. The money. I mean, were you making? You hear stories. We've had guests on to talk about. You don't make as much money as you think you do. You know, in the mob, and you always have to hustle. What was it like?
My father used to pay me $700 a month. Okay, and he
$700 a month.
Yeah,
that's right. Poverty level.
Plus I worked a full time job. Plus, I had my own stuff going on.
So you got to be a criminal, right, to survive?
I made the majority of my money with the cocaine, the powder cocaine.
Right, right. So you had to hustle on the side, even though you were the boss's son.
Exactly.
Right. What about your brothers? Were they? What were they doing at this time? Were they involved with this, or are they?
No, my brother Kurt. When I finally broke away from my father, my brother had Kurt doing some paperwork. My brother went to jail because they didn't. He could have beat it in court, but the government wouldn't give my father a deal. A plea bargain deal if my brother didn't plead guilty.
Mm-hmm.
So my father begged my brother, and so my brother wound up doing 2 years in prison for my dad, which my dad never appreciated.
Right.
You know, in my neighborhood, even though there were a lot of gangsters, all the gangsters' kids, they wanted their kids to go straight. In Chicago, it was a rule, you don't bring your kids into the family. When this happened, a lot of the bosses were mad at my dad. They said he should have never did that. So, you know, I wanted to go to college. My brothers wanted to go to college. My brothers more so than me because they were good in school, you know, and I started working. I had the biggest paper route when I was in grammar school. I worked at 14. I was a busboy at a local Italian restaurant. I always worked, always had two jobs. My brothers worked. So it wasn't like we wanted to go into that life. It was like half the time at the beginning, I'd do it just to appease my father.
Mm-hmm.
And so my youngest brother never got involved.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, my youngest brother and my middle brother caught a lot of beatings just because.
Well, that's quite amazing because your father had hidden in his house, which later came out, something like $2 million in diamonds and $800,000, and you're barely struggling to to survive, and you had to hustle on that.
Well, yeah, my father's defense all through the case was that I stole all these millions of dollars from him, and that I was setting him up so that he wouldn't get out of jail, so I could spend all his money. That I was a bad son. And so after the case was over, myself, my uncle, my brother, a few other people, we assisted the FBI in showing him where some of the hiding places were, and one of them was that house. So even his lawyer was believing. I mean, the taxpayers paid for my father's case. So can you imagine how mad you were
if
you've seen all that money he had? But again, he's a master manipulator.
Wow.
So I was just proving to everybody that my father was lying again.
Wow, you know, that's really amazing. But one of the things that I'm always amazed is that you know, they have the mobsters, gangsters have this life, but they never feel like they're going to, you know, get caught, and, you know, have to go to jail. I mean, what about your family? Was there this sense that this is going to go on forever? Did your father ever feel, because, you know, the FBI eventually took you down.
Yeah, the FBI took us down. They had a weak case against us. But, I was the first one to plead out because of the fact. And there's a whole scenario in the book of what happened. And,
right.
You know, my father always knew. I mean, I never thought I was going to live to be 30 years old, to tell you the truth. My father always knew either you're going to die by getting killed or you're going to wind up in prison for a long time. And yet, when we first got in trouble, it was a different man I was seeing. It was like he didn't want to go. He asked me to go for him, and we'll call it even and do my time and plead guilty. And I agreed to it, too, but it never worked out that way. But, you know, yeah, I mean, you know, that's why, you know, you see these Ponzi scheme people, they a lot of times will commit suicide in prison because they never suspected to go to prison, or
right.
expected, I should say. Whereas in our life, you know, it was part of life, you know. So, you know, yeah, you accepted it. And now you can see, I mean, my father's a very strong man. He's been in solitary confinement for
two years. Right.
And, you know, and he manipulated a priest recently. The priest got indicted. You know, he's very strong. He's a very strong man. So, yeah, he's come to terms with what he's doing.
Right. Let's take another break, Willie, and we'll be back with this fascinating interview. Go ahead, Willie.
No, you bet. At this time, we'll take a brief station identification. You're listening to Crime Beat on the Artist First World Radio Network with Ron Chapsick and Will Rib. Now back to Ron Chapsick and Mr. Frank Calabresi, Jr. for the remainder of the program.
Okay. Frank, tell our listeners where they can get your book. I imagine it's everywhere in the United States, Amazon, bookstores, right?
Yeah. Yes. So Amazon.com, Barnes & Noble. You can go to Random House, any sites online, and most of the stores carry them still, too. You have to go online for the hardcover, but the paperback's out.
Right. And internationally, we have a lot of listeners listening internationally. Is the book available internationally? The rights, you've sold foreign rights to it?
Yeah, it's just coming out this month in Portugal. I mean, not in Portugal, I'm sorry, in Brazil and Portuguese. They were the first ones to buy it, so it's going
right.
to be released in all of Brazil this month.
Right. And e-book?
It is electronic, yeah. It's
right, right. So people can get it as well, too, very instantly, right after the show. On that, and you're on Facebook, and I'm a friend of yours. You have over 1,000 friends, so they could join you.
Yeah.
And keep up with your activities on that sort of thing. But, so you got caught, the FBI, intense FBI inquiry, you go to jail on that then, and the strange thing for me was that you ended up in the same prison as your father?
Yeah.
How why was that? That, you know, that's very, I thought that was very unusual. Usually they want to send you on opposite sides of the country, right? Because, you know, you could come up to shenanigans.
No, actually, I thought it was unusual at first, but they'll put family members together. Won't put co-conspirators together because it's easier because sometimes they run out of places to put people, and they never put co-conspirators together, but if two family members are co-conspirators,
right.
a lot of time they'll put them together.
Right.
It's just a little easier for the families to visit, and unfortunately, out of my uncle, my brother, and me, I was blessed with my father, you know, going to the same prison as my father.
Right.
I was the first one to go in prison out of everybody on the case. And so I was in for a number of months before, and I was in maximum security until I got to the medium security where my father
right.
was at.
How much did you get? How much time did you get?
I got 54 months.
You got 54
months. I wound
up
doing 3 years.
Right, right. And so you spent 3 years, but it must have been really something to see. You thought, you know, it was bad enough being in prison, but here you are seeing your father. Did you see him every day?
You know, I needed prison, okay? I needed to straighten out. And prison wasn't a problem because prison was like the street. I didn't
right.
have a problem in prison, okay? But I thought I was going to have a problem with my father. But I said, you know what, this is my way to work it out with my father. I had been down, I think, 5 months before I got to prison with my father, and then I spent another 8 months before I finally decided to get a hold of the FBI. But yeah, it was rough. But I thought, you know what, you know, I went to Terre Haute Penitentiary for a few weeks in transportation, got locked down over the holidays, and I had a chance to dig down deep inside myself, find out what I was made of, and figure out how it was going to change my life.
Mm.
Now, I heard a lot of people especially the people that loved me. I wasn't suffering in jail. Everybody in the street that loved me, my family was suffering. Mm-hmm. And so I said, you know, I'm going to go. I'm going to make amends with my father. And I'm going to work on our relationship, and I'm going to change my life. Mm-hmm. I've had enough of this. And so that was the way I went into Milan when I first got there with my dad.
Right. Now, did religion play any part in this? I mean, are you a religious person? Or did you? That's a private question, but I mean, it's kind of interesting.
I hold first my family members, my kids. Right. Okay, and I do believe in good and evil, and I do believe in karma. And I know there's going to be a lot of religious people out there going to tell me I'm nuts when I say that, but I do believe in good and evil. I do believe in a God, and but I also do believe in myself, and I have two kids, and that more than anything, I answer to them every day.
Right. Now, you did make the decision. Describe what happened when you decided to go to the FBI, how you did it, and what transpired with the FBI.
So, you know, my dad taught me a lot growing up, okay? He taught me a lot. He groomed me a lot, and he taught me when you make a decision, make sure that it's well thought out, that you can live with it, and when you do it 100%. Don't worry. Don't have fear of anything. Mm-hmm. Don't worry about what could happen. Just worry about what you need to do. And I sat down, and you know, we were doing good for a little bit. But every time me and my father would get together, I would ask him questions I already knew the answer to, which he taught me. Mm-hmm. And every time he did it, he was deceiving me with a lie. So I decided, what am I going to do here? I had two choices. Now in life, sometimes you have to make a decision, and all the choices suck. Well, my two choices I came down with is wait till we get to the street and see what happens with me and my father, which is probably something bad's going to happen. And again, you know, here's a guy that kills with a knife and rope and has done it many a time, so chances are I'm going to be dead, the other one in jail, or cooperate with the FBI. Now, the FBI, you do not cooperate in the FBI. That's the worst thing you can do where I grew up. Right. Okay, you're the scum of the earth if you do that. You don't trust them. This was bred into me. So I says, I can't trust these guys, so what do? So the deal I went to them with is it's a business deal. I don't want no time off. I don't not want nothing from you. I just want to assist you in keeping my dad locked up, and that's where that letter came in. So I had to figure out how to get something to the FBI, and then again, I used everything my father taught me. You know, I typed the letter, didn't touch it, didn't put nothing personal in there, so it can't be come back to me. I can say the FBI is trying to set us up and get us to fight, and, you know, and... So a number of months later, they came, and it took it from there.
Right, and you were, you know, unmonitored, unprotected for about 6 months. You wore wire, you know, and you let your father talk, right? And he talked. So he trusted you, really.
Well, he trusted me because he's seen how good I was doing my time. You know, people say, you know, my father's a very smart man.
Right.
He was a smart man, but he's seen how good he was doing my time that he wanted me back with him. He's like, okay, he is everything I thought he was. So he was so concerned about manipulating me that he didn't think about what my motive is through all this. Mm-hmm. And again, my father taught me, you know what, you want to get somebody to talk, there's two ways to get them to talk. One, alcohol. Well, we're in prison, and my father don't really drink. Or two, get somebody mad, pit two people against one another. And when people are mad, they talk. And that's what I did. My father was mad at my uncle. He thought he was poisoning our minds. So I pitted my father against my uncle. And then I pitted my father against my... I detested the mob. And one thing led to another.
Wow. On that. And, you know...
Hey,
you're,
Ronnie, excuse me,
Willie. One second, please. He trusted you so much that one of the most chilling parts of the book is about the tattoo. And when you were almost made. Talk about that, please.
Well, the tattoo, I'm in the prison yard. I'm wired up like a Christmas tree because what they gave me, they came to give me, didn't work. And, you know, again, I'm unmonitored. If either the prison alarm's going to go off or I'm going to show up 6 hours later in the office where I had to sneak to meet the FBI agents. If the prison alarm goes off, that means I'm dead. My father started talking about a tattoo I got. He just got done mentioning all the bosses and who was involved in the Spilaccio murder from Casino. And all of a sudden he grabs me and says he wants to see the tattoo I got. And if I pull the shirt up, he's going to see wires all over me. And I was able to talk my way out of it. And after that, the FBI started getting, they were concerned about my safety. you know, because it was a close call. And what they wanted to do was get me out of that prison, and they had plans for me that I didn't know about. And that was get me back on the street as soon as possible so I can come and visit my father in a controlled environment.
Wow.
It was really close, yeah.
Right. And, that's a really chilling anecdote. Willie, go ahead.
Yeah. Frank, you talked about the book as a family story. Did you consult with your brothers, or as a matter of fact, your mother, before you made the move to collaborate with the FBI and the authorities?
No, I couldn't, because I couldn't endanger them.
So you were all alone then,
yeah,
making that must have been really, really tough on you. But you were convinced you made the right decision. There's no doubt.
Well, I don't believe that there was a right decision in this. There's none of the decisions were good, but I knew I had to make a decision.
Right.
Okay. And I didn't want anybody involved. One of the things I asked the FBI was that they don't bother my mother, my brother, none of my legitimate friends. Mm-hmm. Don't pull anybody in this. Okay. And, you know, I got to say, everything that I asked from them, they did.
Right.
And, you know, even when I came home, you know, when I first came home, I couldn't tell my, I was divorced, but me and my wife were working on getting back together, and I couldn't tell her, so she didn't know.
Right.
And so it was almost like I was living three lives when I got home. I was living two lives before I went to prison. So it was rough.
Right, on that. But eventually it became Operation Family Secrets, one of the biggest cases ever in the United States. Several mobsters were put away in Chicago, right? How many were put away? And
there was all the top bosses, the whole upper echelon was put away, and this was the first time in the history of the federal government that they used the RICO Act in the way they wanted to use the RICO Act. In
right.
this case alone, there was over 18 murders convicted on, over 40 murders solved. And through all the history of organized crime in Chicago, there was over 1,400 murders, and there was only 14 solved. So this case alone, it was the first time that witness protection was breached in this case. And there's a federal marshal now in prison because
wow.
of that.
Wow.
So there was a lot of history with this case.
Right. And your father got, was it life plus 50 years, I believe?
Right, and what most people don't know is in federal prison, life means life. If you live 300 years, you do 300 years. So
wow.
he has no chance of getting out.
Right. Has he read the book? Do you know?
I don't know. We're not allowed to talk. He's
solitary confinement, right, like you said.
Yeah, it's 12 people in the country are in this program. 10 of them are terrorists. One is my father, and another one is a mobster from New York that had a hit list of prosecutors.
Right, and you've moved on, and we could go for another hour because it's such a fascinating interview, and the story is so complex. But to make it short, you are now living in Arizona, and your wife lives nearby. Your kids are there. How's life been since then? And tell us why you're not in federal witness protection.
In my father's words, I don't scare easy. I'm not coming and challenging people, but I live my life every day. Okay, I have to give them the chance. I'm a simple man now. I work for Lifetime Fitness. I lead a real, it's a big health club corporation. I lead a healthy life. I see my kids daily. They're a very important part of my life. And I wish things can be different between me and my dad. I wish they could have been different between me and my dad, but there was no way they could. I love my father. I don't love his ways. We'll never talk again. We'll probably see each other in the next life, hopefully. Hopefully it'll be different.
Right. I've seen your picture. It's on the cover and other places. You are a scary guy. On that.
I'm not.
Well, you're very soft-spoken on the phone and our discussions before this broadcast. But one final question. In 20 seconds, can you say anything about, do you regret anything about what you've done?
Do I regret? Yeah, I did a lot of bad to a lot of people. And I regret that bad I did. And I try every day to make it up. I try to lead by example. And like I said, I answer to my kids every day. And now the biggest thing is that, you know, what I did to my father, I have to be a better man than him, because if I'm not, I'm a worse man than him.
Right. Well, I think you've moved on with your life, and I commend you for that, Frank. And we thank you so much for being on the show. We want to get you back on when the movie comes out to find out what that experience is like. And good luck with your life, And thank you so much.
Thanks, guys. It was a pleasure.
Okay, thank you. Willie.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks very much, Frank.
Thank you.
Well, Ronnie, wow, what an interview. Like you said, we needed not more than a couple of hours.
Right. I recommend his book to our listeners because we just touched the, you just touched the surface of the book. There's so much more in it.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I'd like to thank Frank for his appearance tonight. It was a very, very fascinating interview. We were delighted to have him on the broadcast. Hey, Ronnie, what did you learn about the interview this evening?
Well, a lot. And, I think Frank's an amazing guy. I mean, he survived a nightmarish existence in the mob. His book deglamorizes it, but he's a survivor. He's just one hell of a tough guy. And you gotta admire the guy for that, even though he did a lot of bad things in his past life. Willie, how about you?
Well, I learned that it's not always like father, like son. Frank Jr. saw the light and changed his ways. And the question remains, what does his father think about his son? It's a very fascinating question. Now, Ronnie, at this time, we're going to bring you a Crime Beats History segment of the month. Piece, August 2012 marks the 50th anniversary of Marilyn Monroe's death. Actress Marilyn Monroe remains one of the best recognized movie stars in the world. The blonde bombshell was remembered by fans, friends, and family on her 50th anniversary of her untimely passing last Sunday. Hey, Ronnie, any comments to this story?
Yes. Can you imagine a woman that died 50 years ago with 3 million Facebook fans? There's actually a Facebook page devoted to Marilyn.
Man.
I know, it's really amazing. I want to draw attention to, for our listeners in the United States, PBS, Public Broadcasting, right after the show at 9 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, will broadcast a special tribute to Marilyn Monroe. So catch that if you can. Wait.
Yeah. You bet. It's going to be a good broadcast. Well, you know what, Ronnie, I have to confess. I still have a crush on Marilyn Monroe, and it's one of the reasons I'm half blind and can't pitch a baseball anymore either.
Right. They said you had imagination when you were young, Willie.
Yeah, I so do, buddy. Just a reminder for all the listeners out there, our next program is scheduled for August 16th, 2012, where we welcome Susan Burke, an attorney representing female military rape victims, in their case against the U.S. military. It's going to be another great show, so make sure you mark it on your calendar. You won't want to miss this one. We hope you enjoy Crime Beat this evening on the Artist First World Radio Network with Lon Chepsik and yours truly, Will Harib. For all you out there, you can listen to our past Crime Beat programs anytime by going to the archive on the Artist First World Radio Network. Wherever you are, we'd like to thank all of you out there for listening to our broadcast this evening. In the meantime, we welcome your emails and thoughts about our program. You can email us at crimebeat123@yahoo.com, and please spread the word about our program. And until next week, and on behalf of Ronnie Chepsik and myself, Will Harib, we hope you tune into Crime Beat next Thursday, same time, at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, where you want to have a front row seat to the fascinating world of crime. Have a pleasant evening, everybody. Good night, Ronnie.
Good sleep night, Willie.